My name is Keller McFaul, and I'm the host of the New Books in Genocide Studies podcast, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. Every month or so, I interview the author of a new or recent book in genocide studies. Today, I'll be interviewing Christiane Garlach, author of the book Extremely Violent Societies, Mass Violence in the 20th Century World, published by Cambridge University Press. When I first received the book, I flipped it open, and I was immediately struck both by the depth and breadth of the research reflected in the endnotes. Garlach has an almost encyclopedic knowledge of the field. I learned a lot from this book about violence in Indonesia and in East Pakistan or Bangladesh, two regions of the world that are part of the genocide studies canon, but as yet are relatively understudied. Moreover, his discussion of counterinsurgency warfare in perhaps 20 countries in the Americas, Africa, and Asia is all-encompassing. Garlach uses this immense knowledge to suggest that people who study genocide need to approach the subject in a different way, one that is broader, one that is more grounded in primary research, and one that uses the categories of ethnicity and race much more carefully. Whether you agree with this contention or not, it's a book that makes you think hard about your own ideas, one of the highest compliments you can pay an author. I have no doubt that Garlach's book will be one of the most talked about books in the field for some time. I had a great time talking with him about it, and I'm sure you'll find the interview just as interesting. Here it is. Hi, Christiane. How are you today?
Hello. How are you doing?
I am very well. Thank you very much. I should tell our listeners that today we have Christiane Garlach, author of a fascinating new book titled Extremely Violent Societies, Mass Violence in the 20th Century World. I thought it was extremely thought-provoking, and I think it's going to prompt quite a bit of discussion. It's got a provocative thesis and frankly, an encyclopedic knowledge of a variety of case studies. I was truly impressed by the kind of range of research the book contains. Christiane, why don't we start just by giving you a chance to say a little bit about who you are and how you got to be that.
Mm-hmm. I am a history professor at the University of Bern, Switzerland. I was born in Germany. For a long time, I was a historian of Nazi Germany, and that included research on some of the most bloody events of Nazi history, including German occupation in Eastern Europe, the murder of Jews in parts of this occupied territories of the Soviet Union by Germans, and as well as in occupied Poland and in German occupied Hungary. Then I moved on, got involved in a comparative study between aspects of the persecution, murder of Jews, and the persecution of Armenians in the First World War. And that became one of the triggers for the book we are talking about. I should perhaps add that I didn't stay in Germany, worked as a history professor in places such as Singapore and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And in part connected with my personal experience, but also connected to other research interests that also included the history of famine and so-called development policy, the world food problem, and so on. I got involved with global history. And that also was important for the book we are talking about, as it takes up case studies from different parts of the world, and is derived from a certain way of thinking that global historians have to search for linkages between different parts of the world, but also to look at them comparatively.
Yeah, I studied under Alan Byerson at Ohio State, and I remember talking with him a year or two ago, and him saying at one point in his career he kind of faced a turning point about whether he was going to look at genocide professionally or whether he was going to look at other kind of military histories, and him saying that he deliberately turned away from genocide studies, and we'll talk later about some of the concerns you have with that label, but and at least partly because he didn't want to study something so grim. Is that something that you kind of thought seriously about when you moved from being a historian of Nazi Germany to this broader question, or did it just evolve?
It evolved. I will not do the study of mass murder and mass violence forever. And I also have, as I said, other research interests. So in that sense, it's not exclusive that I'm dealing with mass violence.
So part of the premise of the book, and perhaps in answering this question, if it fits, you might say a little bit about how you decided to write this book at this time. But as I read the book, part of the book rests on the concerns you have about the way the study of mass violence, whether you call it genocide or ethnic cleansing or crimes against humanity or whatever label you use, and you discuss these in your book, about your concerns about the way this study has emerged. Can you say something about the emergence of the field of genocide studies and how scholars have tried to address this?
I don't want to go deeply into the historiography of genocide and political violence. It seems to me that genocide is a certain concept. If I have problems, that's not only about a term. The concept evolved since the 1940s. Rather Lemkin. It was for some decades primarily shaped or filled with content applied by social scientists and legal scholars, and the field has recently also been entered by many historians. There are some interesting developments in that field. But one problem with actually genocide studies is that I think genocide scholars are in competition with other scholars in the study area of political violence or violence in general. That competition is for academic careers, book contracts, TV screening times, funding for research and other thing, and also for political influence. Genocide is only one concept in the field among many, but some genocide scholars, I think, try to become hegemonic. For me, although genocide studies has moved more than once, at least up to the 1980s, perhaps 1990s, in the direction of becoming stronger empirically, there are still some problems, and those problems seem to me to have to do with this concept, which appears to me a bit too static, if normative, it is action-oriented. For being practical as action-oriented, scholars applying it sometimes simplify things. just to give the gist of my concerns, I think the concept of genocide is too focused on the state and too much concentrating on intent. But in any case, I try a somewhat different concept in order to put some different points of emphasis. But I'm happy to see all valuable insights generated by genocide studies as well as by other approaches in the fields, be it ethnic cleansing or political violence, whatever. It should be a positive competition.
You propose kind of an alternative approach to this, which you call the extremely violent society's approach. What do you mean by that? And how do you think that offers strengths to or opportunities to scholars?
Okay. Concept I derive, I propose is derived from certain observations that came out of my research as well as of that of many others in recent years or perhaps in the last 1 or 2 decades. There are basically three to four essential elements of an extremely violent society. One is the participatory character. So this goes a lot in the direction of looking more at non-state actors and not only be concerned with the state or a government. I suggest the second characteristic is the multi-causality of violence. So there are diverse motives for a diversity of actors and maybe one more than one motive for one set of actors in a certain case of mass violence. And the third is that it's usually not one group that is attacked, but multiple groups that become victims of violence. And that is also important as in genocide studies and a bit beyond, studies are often focusing on one group, like in isolation from the other cases of violence, the other violent action that was going on at about the same time. So, what can one do with it? And it's important to say that a bit unlike perhaps in genocide studies, where it's very important for colleagues to prove this or that was genocide or was not genocide, it's of little value to say, oh, this was an extremely violent society or this was not. Has little point. And the concept is rather meant as a point of departure and not an end point. So then one can try to investigate into the activities of non-state actors, their interaction with state functionaries or other public figures, and so on. Then one can look in the interaction between different motives and how that played out in the dynamics of violence. I mean, I found that the existence of these different motives is very important for the thrust that often develops and the speed in which violent action is taken. Links between the persecutions of different groups, also the links between their responses, their ways of reacting or acting of these persecuted groups, seems also to offer possibilities that sometimes get lost in the research that applies other concepts.
So to the extent that you can create at least a tentative kind of explanation for the prevalence of mass violence in the 20th century, how do you try and explain that?
Oh, well, that's kind of a blanket question. We should perhaps
Indeed.
Discuss this in a bit more detail. It is true that there is something in the subtitle of my book about the 20th century. But the question is how typical all this was for the 20th century as opposed to others, earlier century. If one looks for, sometimes there is not a clear distinction. The most distinctive element, I think, is that of the participatory character of violence. Private interests and so on have been present in cases of mass violence and persecution for centuries. However, I think this participation in the 20th century worked, or since the beginning of the 20th century, has worked in different ways. Because of some, because of the increase of political participation in general, political participation even in states without civil democracy, and that I think is like what is 20th century, what is most 20th century about my book.
So you start out with Indonesia and Armenia. Why Indonesia?
Indonesia, well, how did I pick my case studies? I was looking for cases that have not yet been studied so much by specialists. Understudied cases where there is somewhat sufficient source basis, as we historians say, to do at least a mid-depth study. I mean, we are talking about case studies between like 20 and 100 pages. These understudied cases have in common that usually the archives are not open or not completely open, or they have not been open for long. So scholars have been going for like a substitutional evidence, like they were looking at sources like observations by foreigners, missionaries or diplomats, or so they have looked at survivor reports. In some cases there are not so many, like in Indonesia, and some other evidence that can replace this. Now this evidence often is translated in languages accessible to me, because for such a study with a reach over many countries, it is essential to have such evidence. And these are the understudied cases that appeared interesting to me. I could have chosen other cases, but then in cases like Cambodia or Rwanda, I really would have needed to have the language, the languages, because research so far has already been, has reached a certain depth, and I couldn't have added anything empirically without languages. I hope that in the cases that I studied, I could add something empirically.
I know I learned a lot, and I have to say I appreciate the the caution you show. A number of cases where you basically suggest in the footnotes that this is as far as you can go, and without learning other languages, you can't make any broader conclusions than that. Indonesia and Armenia support, at least as I read your argument, the claim about participation, about the variety of motivations for the perpetrators, and the variety of, in particular, the variety of different groups and the way they interacted. Some of our listeners are familiar with what happens in Indonesia. Some are not. Can you just briefly say kind of what is the traditional narrative of what happens in Indonesia in the mid-60s? And then talk about how your research, what you suggest about the complexities of how violence emerged in that society.
Okay. Indonesia, mid-1960s, this is about the murder, the violent death of perhaps about 500,000 people, leftists targeted by what I call a broad coalition for violence between different state and non-state actors. The scholarly picture so far has become somehow divided. Either scholars see this as having been staged and done by the Indonesian military, so state violence carried out by a certain arm of the government of Indonesia. There's another group of scholars and observers who said, well, this is what really like chaotic violence, mainly generated by non-state actors out of control and enraged by alleged wrongdoings of Indonesian communists. What my study tries to show is that one really needs to combine the two and see all actors and how they worked together. The chapter to a large degree is about the interaction between non-state actors and military actors to find arrest, in part in turn, or in part slaughter alleged or real communists in Indonesia. It is about something like a group of a coalition of political parties, 9 political parties, and about 40 mass organizations that teamed up to persecute communists and then later to bring down the old regime of nationalist, leftist President Sukarno and install a new regime that would become the Suharto military dictatorship that would for 30 years. That has to be taken into account if one reads this as a coalition in which not only the military and certain mass organizations and political parties, but also many other non-state actors in an unorganized way teaming up on free will without clear structures somewhere in the evening and going on the hunt for communists. If one takes that into account, then one can explain the course of events much better. One can also explain why, like, violence straight, like not only leftists were persecuted, but also, as was already fairly known, Chinese ethnic minority, but also especially trans migrants within Indonesia and people who were deviating in terms of their religious beliefs. And this model, I would say that different intensity and overlap of political will between these many state and non-state actors explain why they were, these other groups were hit by violence in other ways and in a differing intensity, but about at the same time as the leftists and communists. Also by this coalition and by the erosion of this short-term coalition, one can explain why violence against leftists was relatively short, and most of Indonesian communists, by far the most, could survive. And why this happened at a certain point in time, because important forces within that coalition for violence, important political parties and important figures in the military, other things became and gained a priority, and therefore the intensity of the persecution lessened. And also for the unorganized people in this coalition for violence, you can, you can link the violence to certain socioeconomic developments, especially the lack of land, especially the mass poverty and famine that kind of correlates with the intensity of violence. And so if you have famine or especially great landlessness, that is the same areas where the violence was especially intense and where before the conflicts between the political left and the political right have been very intense. These are some of the highlights.
Yeah, I'm interviewing Leanne Fuji, right? I think that's how you pronounce her name, sometime in the next week or so, and her book about Rwanda makes some of the same points. I was struck by just kind of a small point you made in the book, a small example about villages who sometimes traded victims as a way not to have to slaughter neighbors. And I don't know how typical this was. This isn't obviously a focal point of your discussion, but I was really struck by the ways in which our kind of traditional understandings of hatred as motivation for killing are not necessarily always as true as we would like to think they are. And this comes through in the Armenian chapter as well, where you basically suggest that the desire to gain wealth and resources was one of the main motivations for at least ordinary people and also the government in encouraging or participating in the deportation or violence against Armenians.
Well, if that was a question, was it?
Well, not a very well-phrased one, but I guess what I'm asking is, what I see, is it correct to read this section of the book as suggesting that we need to expand significantly our understanding of causes for violence beyond what I see as kind of a traditional ethnic or not ethnic, but a group-based or a prejudicial-based explanation?
Yes, and I could only do so much in the book. As I said, these are mid-depth studies. I didn't have enough sources in most cases mm-hmm. to really even be able to do a local study, let alone to really actually carry it out. And local studies or even regional studies might be, may have more of a capacity to really go into detail and link the private private levels with levels of collective group affiliation or ascription to, of belonging to certain groups. So more in the direction of what Stathis Kalibas has suggested, but perhaps himself also only to a degree really carried out with regard, for example, to the Greek Civil War of the late 1940s. And perhaps I should add that the book that I wrote kind of focuses in part on economic interests and economic material factors. That is because these factors usually have been understudied or not fully integrated in interpretations of the events in question. But one could also do this, use the approach I took more or less and trace other important factors that moved people to persecute neighbors or people in their vicinity. For example, in the Armenian case, I was really looking for one set of motives, that is economic greed, and what this did, especially for non-state actors to participate in the persecution, and really not only participate, that's not strong enough, to in part bring it about, because many of the victims, the Armenian victims, died on these almost never-ending marches through deserts over mountains and so on in 1915, and that because they had less and less resources for feeding themselves, buying something to drink, means of transportation, whatever, and less and less clothing, that was also important, and that because they were often one person several times robbed by not only state officials but also by non-state actors. But I could have also spoken about, let's say, a certain religious zeal, a religious set of motivations in persecuting Armenians, and that would also have led to another different point of emphasis. I mentioned this, but it would have been stronger if one would have talked about religion. That is the differences of opinion among the population, because there were also quite a few priests and others, like Muslim priests and Islamic people, who on religious grounds refused to take part in violence or even took measures to protect Armenians. And that, let's also talk about this for just a second. If one talks about participation in mass violence, one also comes to the point of non-participation or deviating behavior, resistance against violence. There are conflict in these societies about whether to apply violence, how much, which, and to which point, against whom. That's also visible in the Indonesian case. Strikingly, in the Indonesian case, the president of the country, several governors of provinces, and several ministers of the federal government were against the mass murder of communists. Also in the military, in the Air Force especially, and also in some units of the ground forces, there was opposition against the mass murder against leftists, and there were leftist leanings. That means, I think that's one overarching result of my book, that it is not enough just to look at the state or the government. That is not a monopoly. Rather, there are conflicts, severe and sometimes violent conflicts, about this mass violence against certain groups within the state apparatus and often also within militaries.
Yeah, Am I right in reading the book to suggest that one of the things you think we need to do, which makes perfect sense to me, is to rethink the kind of categories we've created of perpetrators and bystanders and victims?
Yes. I try not, already tried to signal mm-hmm. with what I just said, first of mm-hmm. all, somebody who was actually in an official function has to be in the actions of such a person have to be analyzed and examined, not only as somebody who carries out government policies. Those government policies may also be evolving and changing, but they're also not carried effect by machineries that just carry out mindlessly what was ordered. Rather, these people have their own interests. They also have their own attitudes and their own little impulses to co-shape policies that makes them important actors by themselves, and you can't just look at them as like cogs in a bigger apparatus. I do not speak, or I try to avoid the term perpetrator in volume because I think it is misleading. It comes out of a juridical context. Courts have not usually been very successful in analyzing and punishing mass violence. Mass violence is the crime with which you usually get away. And so scholars from other disciplines should be careful to pick up terms from there. And the idea of the persecutor seems to suggest that there is a certain circle of persons that can be clearly defined, who were kind of set apart of the rest of society and who can be identified as the responsible persons who have done this and who are responsible for this. I think responsibility is more broadly distributed through society, and there may be persons who were a bit of responsibility for the death of groups or certain persons, although nobody would address them as persecutors, such as in the Bangladeshi case or in the Armenian case, people who charged enormous amounts of money for transporting people, giving them water or whatever. That is not murder, but it did contribute to the death of many people, and it was a kind of, an act that was kind of reflected by the person that carried it out. So, persecutor, I try to replay to talk of persecutors. That's a broader, rather loosely defined term instead of perpetrators. And for the bystanders, I think that this term is also a bit unfortunate. We are discussing the terms shaped mainly by Raoul Hilberg, or popularized by Raoul Hilberg in his 1992 book about the persecution and murder of European Jews. Bystander seems to suggest more of a passive role than I would see in many people's affected. So that's bystander is a very vague concept for a very diverse and large group of historical actors.
You mentioned Bangladesh or East Pakistan, and inherent in that question about what to call it is I guess your concern about the kind of traditional explanations of what happens there. Can you talk a little bit about how people have traditionally portrayed or narrated what happens in that region in the early 1970s, and then say something about how your discussion about that fits into your broader argument?
Right. Okay, we are talking about East Pakistan, rather, in 1971, out of which, because of a civil war, the state of Bangladesh evolved in the end of 1971. The prevailing narrative today is that the Pakistani government, through the Pakistani military, conducted a genocide, carried out genocide against the East Pakistani population in order to crush the autonomy movement in that area, and especially in order to weaken the Hindu element as perceived as agents of a foreign and enemy power, India, as well as of a bad cultural influence. And in the course of this, many people say between 1 and 3 million, and that's the Bangladeshi national narrative, that 3 million people were killed. What I end up with in my analysis is that the number of people directly killed was probably reaching 500,000 or less. And that many, many deaths, there were indeed, was all this, there were killings by the Pakistani military through use of heavy weaponry against civilians and civilian neighborhoods, bombing, artillery, and so on. There were mass arrests and killings. There were some kind of improvised killing centers. There were people cooperating, civilians cooperating with the Pakistani military and militia-like organizations, who also were responsible for many murders, torture, rape, and so on. But the number of victims overall was obviously, fortunately, much lower than the Bangladeshi national narrative, and with it also some genocide scholars see it. And most of these people did not die of direct violence. They died because of hunger, disease, undersupply, exhaustion, and so on. And many of them can be found among the 10 million people who left the country for India as refugees, and then later returned in early 1942. Also, many of these people actually died after the end of the official conflict that was in mid-December 1971, when the Indian Army, together with Bangladeshi independence fighters, overwhelmed Pakistani military in Pakistan. What one sees there is that there is a lot of violence that's actually not coming from state actors. There's a lot of indirect violence, and there are important socio-economic processes involved that actually caused, in this case, many of the killings. People had been driven out of the country, about 10 million of them. Later they could return. Also, up to 15 million people may have been displaced within the countries, these predominantly Muslim, the other, for refugees in India, predominantly belonging to the Hindu minority in Islamistan. But the fact that these, that among these people, many died, and especially little children, families affected, had to do with the fact that their property had been, not only looted, but often dismantled, by neighbors, and they had been driven out of their villages in the first place, often not by the Pakistani army, but by gangs, mobs from neighboring, villages. So one sees that, again, there is a conflictual society in which also non-state actors took action. Whoops. And also, one sees that there are conflicts that are not even on the radar screen of scholars of political violence. Became involved with this, like the struggle for land and the resulting famine. So there was a disconnect between famine researchers and scholars of political violence or genocide scholars. They didn't notice each other, so the famine scholars didn't find out that many of their victims of the famine that is somewhat contested, but I think that has been proved for 1972, were in fact Hindus, and the genocide scholars did not look at the demographic statistics that famine researchers had for 1971-72, and therefore did not come up with figures in the victim numbers in the right dimension. Add to this that there was also a lot of violence against an ethnic minority that was supporting the central Pakistani government, the so-called Biharis, non-Bengali Muslims in East Pakistan, and that this was not, as is often perceived, primarily at the end of the conflict when the independence fighters had prevailed, but in the beginning of the conflict in the spring of 1971. And as for the infamous mass rapes in East Pakistan, it came up that they were not only conducted by Pakistani military and the militias that sided with them, but also by locals, sometimes by family members, and also by the pro-Bangladesh, by some of the pro-Bangladesh guerrillas who came in victoriously in December 1971. So we have a conflictual society in which a lot of, and that's key for my analysis, social mobility takes place. Out of a struggle between elites, in this case, like pro-Pakistan versus pro-Bangladesh elites, the ones rather wedded to land ownership and religion and to the central government, the others large parts of the middle class in East Pakistan. Out of this struggle, there came about a broader, not only regime crisis, but crisis of society. And in that crisis of society, there were consequences for elites, but also for broader parts of the population. Among other things, one of the so-called middlemen minorities, or two of them, were heavily affected by violence. That is, Hindus, as usual with middlemen minorities, not all of the people were wealthy and in a certain social position. There were many poor fishermen and craftsmen and other people among them, but there was also an important residual elite among them, and these their interests were damaged, their wealth was in part taken, And the same can be said about the Biharis and also both Bangladesh civil servants, like were representative within East Pakistan. And another elite could rise in this process, in this violent process. And then there are important, there were important processes on among the lower strata of society, a struggle for land in which certain groups, families got their interests got damaged and they got pushed further into poverty. And that created the so-called international basket case of development policies of the 1970s and 80s. Basket case is a term by Henry Kissinger, who that had to do with broad poverty and high incidence of famine. There was another one in 1974-75 that was also connected indirectly with the events of 1971. So genocide studies and the extremely violent societies approach come here to very different, I would say, to contrast. And the picture that one gets with the glance at an extremely violent society, at participatory violence and multiple victim groups, is much more complex than what was there if one used other concepts.
Yeah, let me pick up on that, because so far, and so far in your book, you've chosen case studies from what by and large might be part of the canon of genocide studies, if there is such a thing. And then there's just this fantastic chapter in there about anti-insurgency strategies and conflicts. And as I read it, you suggest that there's kind of a common strategy that emerges. It has to do with rounding up civilians, putting them in villages or settlements that the military or the government or whoever thinks can be easily defended, and then essentially declaring everything else a free fire zone. Americans might be familiar with this because of the Strategic Hamlet program. So I guess a two-part question. How does this anti-insurgency chapter fit in to this broader claim? And then how does this kind of remarkable commonality of approaches emerge?
Yes, to pick up on the latter question, and there are even some links that one can identify, like manuals, military manuals that were translated from one language into the other, like from English into Portuguese, let's say, or military observers, military instructors being sent from certain countries into other countries. But I found that basically the approaches in question to deal with insurgencies, and especially insurgencies in the countryside, were developed in each case on the spot, very much in like medium to lower general rank of military, strata levels, and also like provincial civil servants and so on, and then later generalized for certain countries. So there is no international of steering all this, and the international lessons or the international parallels did not mean that countries basically took up a theoretical model, read about it, and then applied it at home. It was rather developed each time, new with some variations in the different countries. Now, what I'm talking about in this chapter is, as you know, that's about 20 countries across much of the 20th century. This is about the displacement of 25 to 30 million people and the death of at least 4 million. In the process, the most lethal cases were South Vietnam with the U.S. involvement, Algeria, the Algerian War of Independence, and the French policies of trying to suppress when trying to suppress it, and the Germans in parts of the occupied Soviet Union. Now, what this has to do in like mass resettlements of rural population. And importantly, also the attempt to offer them something that today one would call development, combined with creating militias among this rural population, has much to do with the general arguments of the book. In my book, I try to argue that a lot of 20th century mass violence had to do with a violent transformation of the countryside. In this case, there were insurgency because there were already processes in marginal areas of countries reaching from Guatemala to South Vietnam, Algeria, Portuguese Angola or Mozambique and elsewhere on the planet, British Kenya, underway that created strong social mobility among rural peoples in the countryside, people in the countryside, and also conflicts among them. And then this led to an insurgency by one group or several smaller groups in the first place. But the policies to repress the insurgency basically usually was based on the idea of something like of some social engineering, like steering this process and making it productive for either the colonial power or the national government in place, to make these areas more productive, to integrate them into the nation or into an empire, and not only to bring the militarity under control, but also to bring about social and economic change in a way that was compatible with the interests of those in power. However, this process went out of control in each case. It's very well known, if I may take the cases where the United States were involved more mm-hmm. directly, South Vietnam and El Salvador, by the way, Iraq and Afghanistan, though not fitting in every respect in this case study and not treated there, are similar in that where the United States get involved, there is millions of refugees and displaced people. And then, like in El Salvador, one third of the population, South Vietnam, maybe 40 to 50%, and in Iraq and Afghanistan, also millions. And then it is impossible to repair the damages to a society that are created by this, or to bring, and that's another matter, social change under control. So social change works out uncontrolled, anarchically, somewhat chaotically, but still according to certain patterns. So one is that if regime somewhat prevails, the people in the militias can rise socially and in part also economically. Certain people are damaged. The attempt to draw people in kind of a modern lifestyle, like in Algeria, there were attempts to have men get rid of their beards that look Muslim and women get rid of their headscarves. were only successful to a certain extent. It could lead, like some argue, for Algeria or Kenya to the emergence of actually a national consciousness in displacement camps. In many ways also there was a continuing conflict or between modern and traditional lifestyles and in part some traditional elements remain. The violence in all this is mainly not taking part between the armed formations. Although there are many drawn into militias, usually the power holders have much more power. They actually are aiming at some kind of a supremacy of 10 to 1 in terms of manpower over the insurgents. That is considered to be, you know, sustainable then in order to stamp out an insurgency. But the main victims are civilians, and they, in many cases, like in East Timor, like probably in Guatemala even, like in British Kenya, like in French Algeria, possibly also in South Vietnam, but it's not very well researched. And in many other cases, these people were civilians that are indirectly falling victim to all this process. They were refugees who did not have enough to eat or did not have shelter. There were people who were stripped of their social networks and left without livelihood. Yes, and so they fell victim to this broader process of an attempt of social engineering and its uncontrolled outcomes. If one looks at this purely from a genocide studies point of view, or through the political violence glass, one will usually focus on military or paramilitary and direct killing. And so actually the real issue in these cases in terms of victim numbers is largely left out. And therefore it's important to look and not only at social engineering, planning and military action, but also at a wide variety of actions of diverse groups of historical actors in these processes. This is what I try, of course, very superficially on what is this 80 pages about 20 countries.
You conclude the book with a series of speculations or perhaps tentative conclusions. We don't have time to explore all of them. I just want to, and I should say, I encourage listeners to pick up the book and read them because I think they're really interesting and thought-provoking. But I want to pick up on the one point you mentioned about societies in transitions, because that's what I see kind of pervading the book, is this argument that it is the dramatic social and economic and cultural transitions in these societies which create the conditions or the preconditions for mass violence, and which then feeds back into the transition into kind of a loop to create societies which experience violence not just over a year or two, but for years or decades. What does that say about? There have been people who have suggested that genocide is typical, or mass violence is typical of a particular point in the social or process of social or state development. Does that make sense given your approach?
Yes, but only regarding victims. And also, if one would say, well, you know, if societies are beyond, have socioeconomically developed over a certain point, then they are more secure for violence, then this leaves out the problem that there are large parts of this planet that seem to have difficulties to become an industrial society that would be more secure. But this is only true for victims. In the book, tried to argue that much of 20th century mass violence has taken place in the countryside or in rural areas and small towns, and that this is where the victims are. But if we look at cases like South Vietnam, a whole lot of Nazi violence, for example, also in the Second World War, this was much of the violence came from industrial countries. These were cases of imperialist violence where indeed victims, as for the Nazi case, were mostly located in predominantly rural or somewhat rural areas in Eastern Europe and in non-industrial areas where industries didn't play a large role, where societies were organized in certain ways. But that does not mean that large parts of the persecutors actually came from industrial societies. So industrial societies may have less of a threat of violence against people in their ranks within their borders, but industrial society or a society of having achieved, accomplished a certain wealth does not mean that it does not pose a threat to actually conduct mass violence in other parts of the world. And the same would be could be argued for France in Algeria in the 1950s or for Britain in Kenya in the 1950s. So in that sense, it is only in part comforting that industrial society, people in industrial societies are less prone to become victim of mass violence. Another important, I think, argument of the book is that poverty per se does not lead to a high incidence of mass violence. Rather, it is social mobility, and especially that means sudden impoverishment of poor many people, and also the steep sudden rise for certain groups at the same time at their costs or in part in the course of the same process that plays out in the way that a lot of mass violence is generated. Was that kind of an answer?
Yeah, it was wonderful. We've taken up a lot of your time, and I just want to end with actually just one question, and it's kind of a traditional question. What are you working on now?
I'm working on a brief synthesis about persecution and murder of European Jews in the 1930s and 40s, trying to apply some of the ideas or some elements of the concept of extremely violent societies through that process and trying to come to some perhaps supplementary additional results as compared to what is there so far.
Well, that sounds wonderful. I look forward to reading it. I learned a lot from this book, and I'm sure I'll learn a lot from the next. So I want to thank you so much for your time and for being willing to be with us on New Books in Genocide Studies. And hopefully after you're done with the next book, you'll be back. So thank you very much, Christian.
Thank you.
Take care. You've been listening to an interview with Christian Garlick, author of the book Extremely Violent Societies, Mass Violence in the 20th Century World. I hope you enjoyed the interview and that you'll return to listen to more interviews on the New Books in Genocide Studies podcast, part of the New Books Network.